two of Sven Erik Johansen's Fancies, performed by the Norwegian Soloist Choir with Hans Christian Kjos Sørensen on the marimba. And that's it for this morning's programme. Thank you so much for joining me. I do hope you're going to join James Jolly next week, same time, 9 o'clock, and I'll be back in a fortnight.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
Verdi's Otello, our opera matinee in Afternoon on 3 this Thursday afternoon. From Vienna State Opera with Peter Seifert as Otello and Carlos Alvarez as Iago. The centrepiece of a week of music inspired by Shakespeare to accompany the BBC's season, Shakespeare Unlocked. Afternoon on 3, weekdays from 2 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
Now it's just gone 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Keith Grant first began painting while on national service in the RAF. In the 50s, he went to the Royal College of Art and studied with John Minton and Carol Waite, amongst others. Early influences included Turner, Palmer, Paul Nash and Graham Sutherland. He is the creator of Glorious Landscapes, where I think, Keith, Northern Light plays a huge role.
Enormous, yes. When I was a student, I was looking for an intensification of the English mood as expressed by the neo-romantics. One of my heroes was Paul Nash, but also before him William Blake and Samuel Palmer. And Samuel Palmer's ancients used to go onto hills to see the northern gleam. And I imagined that the north would intensify the mood that I recognised in the very ancient English landscapes. But I needed something that was untrammelled, that had a much more rigorous past. So I read the Viking sagas first, the Icelandic sagas. One of the greatest, I think, is the Njál saga, Saga of the Burning of Njál. And they are full of nature imagery, symbolism and intensity of mood. It's as if the stark elements are interacting with human life in a way that I knew if I were able to be there and it had the same effect on me, I would have found my life's vocation.
It would be nice to just conjure up for the listener the sort of style of your pictures. I've given some idea about talking about the influences. I mean, they see them online probably at the Chris Beatles Gallery because they're quite strongly representational in one sense, but they have a very individual quality that you bring to them. So that although you recognise the landscape or a bird, for example, there's always something which makes it, begins to take it into an abstract realm at the same time.
Well, that is perceptive of you. And I think that the work is largely about space and it's about light. And these, for me, are abstract qualities. And one needs a format in the composition which can support that. And again, in the north, with those immense architectonic landscapes, I saw this abstraction very thinly disguised under the surface of things, and that was the inspiration.
That's rather like in music, I think, possibly if I was relating it to the kind of contemporary music that I'm involved in. It's rather like having an essential sort of tonal centre, but with shifting harmony, so that actually there's a kind of abstraction or an atonality surrounding the tonality, but there are tonal centres.
Absolutely. I think the analogy is a marvellous one. And I've always thought in terms of music when I've been looking at the landscapes in the north. And that's why I think the music that we're going to play is biased towards the evocation of landscape mood.
Well, one of the reasons we homed in on you was that I actually had a phone call from Votan himself.
Oh, yes.
From John Thomas. He simply left a message on my machine saying that he loved your painting and he thought you would make a very good passionee.
Wonderful. Well,
and it is him we're going to hear in the first music.
Yes, it is. Well, he's been a friend for 30 years. His daughter and my daughter went to school together. They shared horse riding together. And so I've had a long association with John. Apart from, and other people have commented more professionally on his voice, but it is phenomenal. It is extraordinary. He's one of the great artists of the 20th and early 21st century, I think.
So this is from Das Rheingold.
Yes.
And it's scene four. Does the music of Wagner, John aside, play an important role?
Very much so. And not all of it, but for instance, the first 40 bars or so of the opening to Das Rheingold, I think, is an evocation of nature spirit, which is quite phenomenal. And I love the association with Erde. I love the symbolism in the ring, which is derived very much from the Prose Edda, which was an Icelandic saga set down by Snorri Sturluson, I think, in the 11th century. And all the characters, for instance, of Votan is Odin, and Fricka is Freya, and Loge, if you pronounce him like that, is Loki.
We'll stick just with Votan and Fricka for the time
being.
Yes,
yes.
Music from Scene 4 of Das Rheingold by Wagner. We heard John Tomlinson singing Wotan, Linda Finney, Fricka, and the Bayreuth Festival Orchestra conducted by Daniel Barenboim. Keith, when you hear that sort of music and also the timbre of Tomlinson's voice, it seems to me that there is a kind of molten mineral quality to it, which actually almost corresponds to some of your landscapes with the more mountainous ones.
Well, how very nice of you to say that. I really do hope that's true. And because I do recognise what you have just said about John's powerful yet mellifluous voice, which is quite extraordinary. And there are more lyrical passages in the handling of paint, which are fortuitous, accidental, which don't come from me. They come from that area, which is quite beyond rational description. And that's where music hits me.
Do you find ever when you're painting, which I sometimes feel with composition, that one is sort of sculpting, that one's actually adding and, you know, almost using sound in my case, paint in yours, as a tactile
entity? Absolutely, ever since the Zen. It is an articulation of space. And you see, I've never considered I'm an artist with a capital A. The only reason I paint is to give some credible visual form to my reactions to nature. I'm not an artist with a big A. I just love doing what I do, and ever since I was a child, that's been the case, my response to nature.
And I think one of your very first responses is very closely allied to the next piece of music by Vaughan Williams.
Very much so.
The Lark Ascending.
Yes, and it was because of listening to a 33 and a third record of Jean Prunier, I think it was. I don't know who the orchestra was, but it was absolutely extraordinary. And so I read the Meredith poem upon which it was based. I don't know what I think of the poem, actually. I think it's wonderful in its imagery. But as a structured poem, I find it perhaps a little bit ordinary, but the music transcended that quite. I couldn't believe the music of Vaughan Williams, and it was in my head for years, while I was painting, and I played it very often.
Thank you.
So it is not just because I had sold one of my first paintings called The Lark Ascending that this piece of music means so much to me. It is a memory of my childhood in the fields north of our home near Liverpool, when the spiralling, cascading sound of the lark seemed to be all around one. And then having a John Clare experience and finding a skylark's nest for the first time, a wonderful little cavern woven into the coarse grass with a clutch of about 5 olive green eggs. I remember the frisson.
It's a very happy sound, isn't it, when you first hear skylarks?
Yes, amazing, wonderful.
We heard there Hilary Hahn playing the violin with the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Colin Davis in The Lark Ascending by Vaughan Williams. Well, now, Keith Grant, you live or have done for the last few years in Norway.
Yes, I've always wanted to live in Norway, and I was quite prepared to live by myself. But I was invited to go to the north of Norway and take part in an artistic happening, in fact, in a town called Sortland, right in the far north. And there I met my wife, who was playing the clarinet on the last day of the project work, when the whole town, 4,000 people, 2,000 of them, turned up to the exhibition. And Hilda was playing there, and she told me she wanted to go to art school. I was astonished because I thought she played so well. Why do you want to go to art school? But we had a talk about art. I sent her a card of The Lark Ascending to say it was nice to meet her, and it arrived on her birthday.
And it is a Norwegian composer, perhaps the most prominent, whose music we hear next, Arne Nordheim.
Yes. First of all, I love The Tempest. I think it's, for me, Shakespeare's most wonderful play. It's wonderful because of its magic, because of its sea surge, because of the fact that it's an island. I'm not so into the gender issues with Miranda or the colonial exploitation of Caliban or the power dominance of Prospero. Those are in the play, I know, but they mean so much less to me than the overall effect of unbelievable mystery.
And Nordheim's music?
I think Nordheim's music is absolutely wonderful, and I don't think I've heard an evocation of the build-up from a gentle sea surge to a storm and then to the awakening of those two young people, and I think it's immensely significant.
Thank you.
Calm Sea, Storm and Awakening from The Tempest, and that was a suite from the ballet by Arne Nordheim. We heard Susan Campbell, the soprano, Christopher Keat, the baritone, with the South German Radio Symphony Orchestra and Choir, conducted by Charles Darton. Now, Keith Grant, having looked at your painting, I didn't think you could possibly put together a programme for us without the music of Sibelius. What does he mean to you?
Everything. He is one of the prime voices of the North, evocation of the Northern spirit. And one of the great works which inspired him was the Kalevala, which is an epic drawn from folk history, drawn from the oral tradition, as Homer is said to have created the Iliad and the Odyssey. But I've chosen the Luonnontar, which is from the first canto of the Kalevala, and it concerns the creation of the world. And it concerns a young girl, the bride of the air. She is a nature spirit, or an earth mother. She descended from the air, landed in the sea, swam for 700 years, raised her knee above the water, and a teal, looking for a place to nest, landed on her knee. The egg was so warm, she tumbled it off into the water, where it broke in two, the lower half creating the earth and all the creatures, and the upper half creating the heavens and the universe. And I think that's a wonderful creation myth. And it is a most difficult piece to sing, I'm told. And a lot of the intonation is based on the Finnish rune singing, which was a song which contained passages of weeping or simulated weeping. And very few non-Scandinavian singers have been able to accomplish this perfectly.
Thank you.
It's quite a visionary score, that, isn't it, in the way that it seems to look ahead of its time.
Wonderful. And Luanatar, the mother of creation, the earth mother, the modern Norwegian word for midwife is Jordmor, earth mother.
We heard Marianne Hagander singing with the Gothenburg Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Jorma Panula, in music from Luanatar, the opus 70 of Sibelius. You mentioned earlier, Keith Grant, that you liked Hardy.
Yes.
And then you liked Vaughan Williams. So that suggests to me a possible liking too for Hausmann.
Very much so. Hausmann has had a tremendous influence, and particularly the poems from A Shropshire Lad. I know many of them by heart, but the ones that Vaughan Williams chose for the song cycle on Wenlock Edge, I couldn't better. And the particular one which we're going to play, From Even Morning and Yon 12 Winded Sky, that for me is a marvellously oceanic atmosphere and mood of the urgency and transience of life, which is something that I find emphasised all around me in the north. And I find this a northern expression.
From far, from even morning, and yon 12 winded sky, the staff of life to
From Far, From Eve and Morning, from On Wenlock Edge by Vaughan Williams. We heard Philip Langridge, the tenor, with Howard Shelley playing the piano, and the Britten Quartet. I'm quite struck, Keith Grant, by how your interest in contemporary composers mirrors, as I said before, very much your own work. And I think that's true of the next composer, John McLeod.
Yes, I think it is. I think John is a wonderful composer, and I think the particular piece that we're going to play, the Gokstadship, which John wrote, I think, over 30 years ago now, and it's so expressive of his subject, not just the beauty of the boat and the marine intelligence of which went into the construction of these fantastic vessels, but the way he's used the actual construction in the build-up of the music in 16-note patterns. The boat is made of 32 huge planks, 16 on each side.
And it's preserved in Oslo, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it's preserved in the Viking Ship Museum. There are three boats there. One is the Oseberg ship, which we don't think ever went to sea, but this one, actually a replica was made of it at the end of the 19th century and sailed to America. So it's a most wonderfully seaworthy vessel.
And quite a beautiful thing to look at, too, almost like a sculpture.
Unbelievable. Well, I find that with anything that we make, which has to be subject to the elements always has a quality about it which is undeniable, an aesthetic quality as well as the utilitarian quality. But John's music conjures up for me not just that ship, but the whole notion of ships in the Viking era, not just for their predatory expeditions, but also in their funeral rites, which is most beautifully expressed, as you probably know, in the myth of Baldur, who was the sun god and so needed by all of nature. Nature took a pledge not to harm him. Loki, who's Loge in the ring, decided he would kill the sun god, and so he fashioned something that wasn't of nature, a mistletoe bough, and killed him. He's put into a boat, Baldur, and it's pushed out to sea and it's set alight. And that Viking ship became the sunset as the sun was going down. The whole of nature weeps for him. That is the melting of the ice and the snow in the thaw, and the sun rises up again to the 24-hour day.
Thank you.
The opening of The Gokstad Ship by John McLeod, the Polish Radio and TV Symphony Orchestra, were conducted by the composer. You mentioned prior to that, Keith Grant, the myth in which the boat is pushed out with the corpse, and that immediately brought to my mind the end of Peter Grimes, when Grimes is advised to sail out to sea and sink the ship, sink the boat anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's rather apposite, since you knew Britton and Piers quite well, didn't you?
I did, particularly Peter Piers, who was a patron, a very staunch supporter of my work, and he became a fantastic friend.
And did you go to Aldborough? Because I think they commissioned a piece from you for there.
Well, they didn't, but what happened, I made a series of Aldborough paintings. I made a series of drawings too on the turn of the screw, which are now in the Britton Piers Library.
Didn't you tour with them the Maltings after it was burnt down?
Yes, I did. On the morning after the Maltings was burnt down, I went with Peter and Ben through the ruins and saw a grotesque, bestial-looking apparition, which was his melted grand piano. And Ben was practically in tears. But he said, well, these wonderful Suffolk brick walls, they're still standing, and we did 1 year. The opera house had been rebuilt.
Unquestionably one of the masterpieces of Britton, and one in which Piers played an absolutely pivotal role, both inspirationally and performing, is the Serenade. Which particular part of it?
Well, I've chosen the Blake poem. Blake has always been a fantastic influence, and particularly his connection with Samuel Palmer. But O Rose, Thou Art Sick, it is a darker side of Britton's psyche. But it is within that theme where he was incensed at the corruption of innocence, incensed at the exploitation of beauty, of the destruction of it. And I'm sure that this setting for this poem comes from that deep emotional response he had to the injustice, actually, that exists in life and in nature. miraculous horn playing. Absolutely wonderful.
Wonderful, by Barry Tuckwell, inspired, of course, by Dennis Brain, who inspired Britain to write for the horn in that way. We heard Peter Pears with Barry Tuckwell and the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by the composer Benjamin Britten, in the Elegy from the Serenade. Actually, I think the dirge that then follows is one of the most terrifying things he ever wrote.
Indeed, and the words of that are just extraordinary, excruciating.
I'm really grateful, Keith, that you've brought us things that we don't have so frequently on the programme, the Nordheim, the John McLeod, and now some Rautavaara, who is not that frequently programmed here.
No. He was a great admirer of Sibelius. He, like many Scandinavian composers, wrote for university ceremonies, and this Cantus Arcticus was written for the most northern university in Finland, University of Oulu. And he tried to be very different. He was very different. And in fact, he used as the soloists for this piece recordings of birds that he had made, recordings of wild swans, of cranes, and of other unrecognized species, which were set up by him in some sort of avian counterpoint with the orchestra also imitating the bird sound as well. It makes for me just a most wonderfully expressive evocation of the north, and I think it's something marvelous for us to end the program on.
Well, this is the first movement from Cantus Arcticus, and it's called The Bog. The Bog, the first movement from Cantus Articus by Rautavaara, the Lahti Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Osmo Vanska. I wonder, finally, Keith, whether you would recognise a particular quality that I sometimes detect in your painting, and which I like in the works of painters as diffuse as Gauguin, Blake, and even the late Craigie Aitchison, which is a kind of almost primitivism. I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but in one that actually I like. Would that be fair?
Yes, it would. There's something which is not academic about it, not schooled. It's something that comes spontaneously and intuitively. And if I can get in my future work something of the quality of the mood that we've just experienced in that piece, I will be immensely happy.
Well, Keith Grant, I'm very glad that we obeyed the command of Votan. How can you refuse it? And had you with your music on the programme. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Keith Grant was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week, Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the actor, playwright and director Stephen Berkoff. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's edition was Chris Marshall. Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly. Welcome along to the afternoon here on Radio 3, which continues in just a moment with a chance to hear the music of two little-known English composers from the 17th century, one of whom was the father of a very famous English poet. Find out who he was in the Early Music Show, which follows a summary of the BBC News this lunchtime, read by David Cornett.
The Taliban says a series of coordinated attacks in Afghanistan mark the start of its spring offensive. Most of the assaults were launched in the capital, Kabul, where foreign embassies and the country's parliament building were targeted. But attacks were reported in at least four other provinces, including Jalalabad, where the airport came under siege. The Labour leader, Ed Miliband, has offered to limit donations to his party from trade unions to £5,000. But he said he wanted to keep the system whereby individual union members are asked if they want to keep paying £3 a year to Labour. The Conservatives say unless those donations are tackled, Mr Miliband's proposals are virtually meaningless. A group of 46 philanthropists have called on the government to rethink plans to limit tax relief on charitable donations. In a letter to the Sunday Telegraph, they said the cap could deter future donors. Ministers have said they want to stop wealthy people reducing their tax bills, sometimes to zero, by giving to charity. There's been more fighting between government forces and rebels in Syria ahead of the expected arrival of United Nations ceasefire observers in Damascus tonight. Syrian opposition activists say forces loyal to President Assad have resumed shelling of the central city of Homs. The blast furnace at the former Cora Steelworks in Teesside will be relit this afternoon, more than 2 years after production stopped. The plant was bought by a company in Thailand, SSI. They've taken on more than 1,000 workers, and it's thought further jobs could be created. The RSPCA has called for a number of changes to be made to the Grand National after two horses died during the race yesterday. The charity says the number of horses taking part should be reduced, and it was also concerned about the design of the jumps. A minute's silence has been observed in Belfast, where the Titanic was built to mark the centenary of the ship's sinking. Bronze plaques listing the names of those who died were unveiled in a memorial garden in the city this morning. And the weather, a dry and mostly sunny day. It'll feel rather chilly, but it'll be pleasant in the sunshine. BBC News and Weather at 1:03.
David, thank you very much. The late quartets of Shostakovich are the subject of our Sunday concert this afternoon. The Pacifica Quartet play the number 11, the 12th and the 13th in an hour from now in a recital recorded last month at Wigmore Hall in London. But next, this lunchtime, it's time for today's Early Music Show, which is introduced by Catherine Bott.
Thank you. The Fall of the Leaf, one of the most famous pieces from the 17th century Fitzwilliam virginal book, in an arrangement for recorder and lute, played by Hans Martin Linder and Konrad Ragosnich. The Fitzwilliam virginal book is a treasury of 297 keyboard pieces by various composers, dating from about 1562 to 1612, and that little ditty was one of four pieces in the collection by Martin Pearson, who's the focus of today's early music show. Later in the programme, I'll be talking to Richard Rastall, Professor Emeritus of Leeds University, whose work in editing and reconstructing Pearson's works over more than 20 years has been a considerable labour of love. But before we hear from Richard, let's hear one of those pieces he's so lovingly helped to restore. This is Pearson's Latin motet, Quid Vobis Videtur, and it's sung by the ex-cathedra consort conducted by Geoffrey Skidmore.